The New Testament's Use of the Old Testament, the eighth talk in a series titled Reading the Book, Lessons in Understanding the Bible, was presented by Ron Julian on May 22, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Tonight in our class, it's called Reading the Book, talking about how to approach reading the Bible. And I hope that by now, those of you who've been coming to this get the idea that I'm trying to get across here. I'm trying to give you some examples to illustrate some of the issues that we face when we look at the Bible. Before this class is done, I have some comments. I don't mean today, but before this whole series is done, I have some comments that I want to make about, in general, what I'd like you to do with all of this. What's the point of what it is we've been doing together here? But I'm sort of saving that up for the end. Tonight, I want to continue on with a discussion we've started about the use of the Old Testament in the New Testament. I showed you and tried to make the point that I think it's important, if the New Testament authors are referring to something in the Old Testament, that it's important for us to go back and actually see what it is that's happening in the passage in the Old Testament and make sure that we understand the point that they're making. Tonight, what I want to do is sort of take head on the question that has been raised about the New Testament use of the Old Testament. What do I make of that? What are we supposed to do with what seems to be some pretty strange stuff sometimes? When the New Testament authors refer back to the Old Testament, it seems sometimes as if they're not paying any attention to the context or what the passage was actually saying back in its original context. And if that's the case, what sort of confidence can we have in the New Testament authors if they can't even understand the Old Testament? If I can look at the Old Testament and tell clearly that the passage is not saying what it is they're saying it's saying, then how much confidence can I have in the New Testament authors? So what I'd like to do is give you, I don't know how it's going to work tonight. I have two passages that I would like to talk about, and I'm not sure how it's going to work, whether we're going to be able to talk about both of them. I'll get in one at any rate. I want to give you an example here of a place where we run into what seems to be a problem when we look at the way the New Testament authors are using the Old Testament. And I want to tell you how I think about it. My purpose tonight is a little different than some of the things that we have done. What I'd like to do here is propose to you, give you what my own thinking is about how these kinds of problems can be approached. This is not the sort of thing that you're going to run into everywhere. I mean, you can pick up the New Testament and open it up, and you may come to whole pages that you could read through that you're not going to find any strange uses of the Old Testament. It's not like every page is filled with them. But there are enough places where we have questions like that that I would like to kind of show you what I think at least a possible way of explaining what it is they're doing might be. So I want to start by going to the book of Matthew. Book of Matthew is filled with good examples of this. I mean, Matthew is almost a textbook case in, oh my gosh, what in the world is he doing with the Old Testament? The passage that I want to look at in particular starts, it is in chapter 2, and starts with verse 16. We could have started in verse 13 and looked at the that section, which ends with his quotation, "Out of Egypt did I call my son." That's a good one, because that's a tough one to understand what's going on. I decided for tonight to look at the next one. It starts in verse 16. "Then when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged and sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all its environs, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had ascertained from the Magi. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, saying, A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be comforted because they were no more." Okay. Well, as we'll see as we go into this, the problem that this represents is that when we go and read Jeremiah, it seems fairly clear that this passage in Jeremiah is not a prediction of the death of the infants in Bethlehem. That's not what this passage is. So what does Matthew mean when he says that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled? Because it sure sounds like what he's saying is that was a prediction that this was going to happen, and here's the event. So that's what I'd like to start out looking at. What is it that Matthew's doing here? What is it that's actually happening in the passage, and how can we make some sort of connection? Now, again, I know that the question of whether an Old Testament prophet predicted something that happened in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago may not be like the most burning question on your mind as you're living your life day to day. But to me, it's a very significant question because I've invested my entire life in the truth of this book. And so I want to be able to understand what it is the book is saying and why it is I should have confidence in what it's saying. So, to me, it's a significant question, and I hope I can show you the significance of it as we go along. Let me start out by talking about this word fulfilled. Matthew said, that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. Our typical way of understanding what that word means is, we have a prophet in the Old Testament who has made a prediction. He has said something like, you know, in the future, the Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem. And sure enough, when we go and look at it, the Messiah is born in Bethlehem. Years later, that's what happens. So what we tend to think of when the word fulfilled is used is the prediction was made, and in the future, the event happened just as it was predicted, and thus the event in the future fulfilled the prediction. You may recall a couple of weeks ago, we looked in the book of James, where James was talking about faith and works, and we looked at James' appeal to the story of Abraham. And in that story, we see Abraham at a certain point being promised that he would have children, that he would have a child in particular, and that from that child a great number of descendants would come about. He believed the promise, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. And then, years later, when that child has been born, God asks him to give him back as an offering, and Abraham shows his willingness to do that. James, you may remember if you were here, says about that when he was willing to offer up Isaac, that the passage earlier in Genesis, which said Abraham was justified, God reckoned it to him as righteousness, that passage was fulfilled. Now, in that situation, there's no question. The passage that says Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness is not a prediction. It is not a prophetic prediction that says someday Abraham is going to offer up Isaac on the altar. It was just a statement about Abraham's faith. And yet James is coming along and saying that when Abraham was willing to offer up Isaac, it fulfilled the passage where it describes him being justified by his faith. And I argued that the idea is, the connection between them is that the faith that Abraham said he had and that he felt in his heart when he heard the promise earlier, he actually acted on and lived out later when God asked him to offer up Isaac. So what was implicit, the idea that was implicit and hidden in the earlier passage, comes out to the full. It is fulfilled in that it is filled out. It is lived out. The faith that was implicit here has become actualized and real. Something like that. Well, that's a different use of the word fulfill than we're used to. But I think it's very significant for us to see that, because I would argue that in some of these passages where the New Testament authors say an Old Testament passage was fulfilled, I think that they have something more in mind, like what James was saying. They're not saying that was a prediction, and when this happened in the life of Jesus, this is the event that it was predicting, but rather there's something implicit. There's something about this passage. It tells us something that finds its greater fulfillment in the events surrounding Jesus' life. So my basic argument would be that we should think about this in different terms. When we go back and look at this passage in Jeremiah, we're not going to find a prediction about what happened in the life of Jesus, but we're going to find something else. Okay, now, in order to see what that is, we need to go back to the book of Jeremiah in the 31st chapter. In order to set us up for what's happening there, there's something that I want to explain. You may remember Abraham had Isaac, his son. Isaac had Jacob. And Jacob had 12 sons. They were not all with the same woman. There's a very complicated story, you may recall, with Jacob being tricked into marrying the wrong woman, and he had to work 7 more years so that he could marry the right woman. And some of the children he had were with handmaidens and so on. The story is complicated. But what we're concerned with right now is Rachel. Rachel, the one that Jacob had 2 children with. Rachel had, first of all, Joseph. Joseph went on to have 2 children. When he went off to Egypt, he married there and he had 2 children, Ephraim and Manasseh. Jacob adopted Ephraim and Manasseh into his family. So if you can kind of picture the way things work here, we've got Joseph, we've got Jacob up here, Jacob as the father of the 12 tribes, but through Rachel, he has Joseph, who comes along and has Ephraim and Manasseh. And these two get adopted into the family. In essence, they come to have rights equal to any of Jacob's other children. So, whereas Joseph, in essence, what has happened to Joseph is that his line has gotten 2/12 of the pie now, instead of just the one that would be his. Each of his 2 children has become a son of Jacob. And so Ephraim inherits a place in the family, and Manasseh inherits a place in the family. And then finally, Jacob, through Rachel gives birth to Benjamin and dies. She dies in childbirth. So, Rachel is the mother of Joseph and Benjamin, but in terms of the tribes of Israel, she's basically the mother of three of the tribes, Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. Okay? Now, when she dies, the story, we read it in Genesis 35:16. Then they journeyed from Bethel. This is Joseph, this is Jacob and Rachel. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel began to give birth, and she suffered severe labor. And it came about when she was in severe labor that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, for now you have another son." And it came about as her soul was departing, for she died, that she named him Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin, Benjamin. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar over her grave. That is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. So, in giving birth to Benjamin, Rachel dies. They were on their way from Bethel to Bethlehem. Now, on this map, I don't know how many of you are going to be able to see it. I'll try to get out of your way here in a minute. But we have Jerusalem here, about 5 miles to the north is Ramah. A little bit above that is Bethel. Ramah is going to enter into this in a minute. Jacob and Rachel are on their way from Bethel to Bethlehem. And Bethlehem is about 5 miles to the south of Jerusalem. So they're on their way to Bethlehem, but before they get there, they're some ways away from Bethlehem. Rachel dies, and her grave is set up. There is a traditional spot near Bethlehem where Rachel's grave is. But I don't know. There's some dispute in the scholarly literature that I've read as to whether we accept that as being the actual site or whether it's gotten moved over time. But somewhere on the road towards Bethlehem is the grave of Rachel, the mother of Benjamin, Manasseh, and Ephraim, and Joseph along with that. Okay? Now we come to Jeremiah. Things move along. In order to get us to what we find in Jeremiah, we have to realize that those descendants, those tribes that develop from Jacob, ultimately end up coming into this land and settling. The 12 tribes divide up the region and end up in various parts of the Palestine area. And as is the way of things, it wasn't so very long until they weren't getting along with each other, and instead of being one united kingdom, they split. And you have what was referred to as Israel in the north and Judah in the south. Most of the 12 tribes were up in the north, and a couple of the tribes were in the south, Judah being the most important of those tribes. Jerusalem is in the southern kingdom. In the northern kingdom, they decided that they were going to set up their own temple, their own altar to God, and worship Him in their own way. And so you basically have these rival temples, one in Jerusalem and one in the north. And the two peoples basically were at enmity with each other. The dividing line between them would have been somewhere just up north of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was near the northern part of the southern kingdom. So the dividing line was right along in here. Now, after a number of years, the Assyrians came along. And by a judgment of God, as it is described in the Old Testament, because of the godlessness of especially the people in the north at this time, they are conquered and taken into captivity. The Assyrians come along and take Israel, the northern kingdom, into captivity to Assyria. The southern kingdom is sort of bruised in the process, but they remain intact and they are not taken into captivity. Fast forward, and we find the same situation is about to happen to the southern kingdom, only this time it is the Babylonians who are coming in. And the Babylonians are taking the southern kingdom into captivity. So first the northern kingdom was taken into captivity, and then the southern kingdom was taken into captivity. That's the historical situation that we find when Jeremiah is writing. He is writing at the time that the Babylonians are coming in and doing all of this stuff. So the theme that was very predominant among the prophets who predicted that this would happen, or the prophets that, like Jeremiah, who were writing as it was beginning to happen, was what happens to the promises of God? God has made these great promises to Abraham concerning his descendants and the great blessing they're going to be. God has made this promise to David that his throne is going to last forever. And where are all those promises now? Because everybody's being taken into captivity. What's going on? And so one of the themes that the prophets talk about is God's faithfulness to his promises and the fact that he is going to bring everyone back, ultimately. Bring them into the land, forgive them, establish them, and set them in peace and righteousness in the land with the king descended from David ruling over them in peace. The Messiah, in other words. So the prophets talk about this day coming when everyone is going to be restored to the land and God will be ruling through the Messiah over them all and everything will be restored. But what we have right now, as Jeremiah is writing, is a situation where the northern kingdom has already been decimated and the same thing is happening to the southern kingdom and everything is in great disarray. Now, in order for us to understand the passage that Matthew is quoting from Jeremiah, there's one more piece that I think is helpful to understand. Rachel's children, Benjamin and Joseph, and through Joseph we've got Ephraim and Manasseh. The three tribes, Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin, are right here above Jerusalem. They're the major, in this major section of the northern kingdom. Ephraim was right up here, a big area. Benjamin was right above Judah here. And Manasseh was just up above that. So Manasseh, Ephraim, and Benjamin are a major part of the northern kingdom. In other words, Rachel's children, the children who are descended from Rachel specifically, of the 12 tribes, those that are related to Rachel through Jacob form the predominant part of the northern kingdom, the ones who have been taken into captivity already. Okay, so everybody, is that clear enough what I'm saying here? So when we talk about Rachel's children, we are likely talking about the northern kingdom. And in fact, if you look through the prophets, there are two terms that the prophets tend to use to refer to the whole northern kingdom. One of them is the word Israel. It's referred to, the northern kingdom is referred to as Israel. And it's helpful when you read the prophets to be aware of that. When we read Israel, we tend to think of the whole thing. But most of the time in the prophets, Israel means this northern kingdom up here. But the other term, the other name that is given for the whole northern kingdom is Ephraim. Ephraim, which is kind of the largest territory, the son of Joseph, Ephraim, his name has sort of come to be associated with the whole northern kingdom. And it's not uncommon for the northern kingdom to be referred to as Ephraim. Ephraim descended through Rachel. Okay. So, let me start reading to you in Jeremiah 31. God has started to declare through Jeremiah the restoration of the peoples. Now, this is a big deal. The northern kingdom was decimated by the Assyrians. The southern kingdom is being decimated by the Babylonians. But at that time, declares the Lord, I will be the God of all the families of Israel, and they shall be my people. All the families. The whole deal is going to be back again. Thus says the Lord, the people who survived the sword found grace in the wilderness. Israel, when it went to find its rest, the Lord appeared to him from afar, saying, I have loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore I have drawn you with loving kindness. Again I will build you, and you shall be rebuilt, O virgin of Israel. Again you shall take up your tambourines and go forth to the dances of the merrymakers. Again you shall plant vineyards on the hills of Samaria. The planters shall plant and shall enjoy them. For there shall be a day when watchmen on the hills of Ephraim shall call out, Arise, and let us go up to Zion, to the Lord our God. Well, with some of the background we've had here, maybe you can see a little bit of what's being said. Samaria is this region up in the north, in the northern kingdom. Samaria is going to be the restored. In the hills of Ephraim, they're going to be planting vineyards. The watchman will be there and call out and say, Arise and let us go up to Zion, to the Lord our God. Zion, that's Jerusalem. So we have a picture here of one day in the north, they're going to be restored, they're going to be putting vineyards in Samaria, and on the watch, the watchman in Ephraim will say, let's go to Zion. In other words, that dispute between them is going to be over. No longer will they be worshiping up in the north, but they'll say, let's go to Zion, to Jerusalem. That's where we're going to go. So it's a picture of not only the restoration back into the land, but the healing of the breach between the northern and southern kingdom. For thus says the Lord, sing aloud with gladness for Jacob, and shout among the chiefs of the nations. Proclaim, give praise, and say, O Lord, save thy people, the remnant of Israel. Behold, I am bringing them from the north country, and I will gather them from the remote parts of the earth. Among them the blind and the lame, the woman with child, and she who is in labor with child together. A great company they shall return here. With weeping they shall come, and by supplication I will lead them. I will make them walk by streams of waters, on a straight path in which they shall not stumble. For I am a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn. Hear the word of the Lord, O nations, and declare in the coastlands afar off, and say, He who scattered Israel will gather him, and keep him as a shepherd keeps his flock. For the Lord has ransomed Jacob, and redeemed him from the hand of him who is stronger than he. And they shall come and shout for joy on the height of Zion, and they shall be radiant over the bounty of the Lord. Over the grain and the new wine and the oil, and over the young of the flock and the herd, and their life shall be like a watered garden, and they shall never languish again. Then the virgin shall rejoice in the dance, and the young men and the old together, for I will turn their mourning into joy, and will comfort them, and give them joy for their sorrow, and I will fill the soul of the priests with abundance, and my people shall be satisfied with my goodness, declares the Lord. Now, I wanted to read all of that to you because I want you to get the idea that this passage in Jeremiah, this chapter here, is basically a chapter of positive good news. This is the proclamation of God, of His intent to restore His people, to give them joy, to undo the thing that has been done. So, this prophecy of Jeremiah is incredibly significant in terms of the promises that God has made to Israel, to both the north and the south, that He is going to be faithful to them as the children of Abraham. So this is a great theme. I mean, this is not a proclamation of judgment. This is a proclamation of forgiveness and restoration when the days of judgment are over. Okay. Then, thus says the Lord, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are no more. Thus says the Lord, restrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears. For your work shall be rewarded, declares the Lord, and they shall return from the land of the enemy. And there is hope for your future, declares the Lord, and your children shall return to their own territory. Okay, so in the prophecy that Jeremiah is making here, we are picturing a voice is heard in Ramah. Ramah is about 5 miles to the north of Jerusalem. Rachel's tomb is somewhere probably between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, 5 miles to the south. So the tomb of Rachel is probably, picture it, 8 miles away or something from Ramah. Ramah seems to have been one of the cities where the conquerors would take the people from the area and gather them together on their way into captivity. That seems to be what happened when the Assyrians took those in the north into captivity. The Babylonians were doing the same thing for those that were left in the north, and for their conquering in the south, they were taking them to Ramah, sort of gathering them together, getting everybody straight, and then marching them off to Babylon. Okay, so Ramah seems to be the place where the conquest is sort of being felt. Here are the hordes of Israelites being gathered together as they're being marched off into captivity. And what is it saying? A voice is heard in Ramah. It's like from the distance, from the tomb of Rachel, we hear a voice weeping and lamenting for her children. Rachel, you understand, at this point has been dead for a long time. I mean, these are the children of the children of the children of the children of Rachel that we're talking about. And we're probably talking in particular about the northern kingdom. This section has concentrated on the northern kingdom, talking about a restoration in the northern kingdom. And as I said, the children of Rachel probably are talking about her specific children, which were all the main tribes up in the northern kingdom. So Rachel, just right on the very southern edge of the northern kingdom, in her grave, is being pictured as weeping over the deportees. They're all being taken away. But the promise that is being made to her is, restrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for your work shall be rewarded, and they shall return from the land of the enemy, and there is hope for your future, and your children shall return to their own territory. So the weeping in this context is over the judgment that God has brought on the northern kingdom, but now the promise is being made that a restoration is going to come one day, and they will be brought back. So Jeremiah, the message in the prophecy is, Rachel, stop crying. It's going to be okay. Ultimately, they're going to come back. And then, if we were to follow through here, we would find a section now that goes on to talk a little bit about the southern kingdom, Judah, which is also facing its own problems and its own restoration that is going to enter into, until finally we arrive at around verse 27 of chapter 31, God talks about what he's going to do for both. Days are coming when I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man and with the seed of beast. And then most famously in verse 31, behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. So this chapter 31 of Jeremiah is a very famous passage talking about the new covenant that God is going to make with Israel the northern kingdom, and with Judah, the southern kingdom, bringing them back together, writing his law on their heart, restoring them, forgiving them, bringing them into the land, and making them a people of God, a people who are truly committed to God, who know God, who, as he goes on to say, no one has to teach his neighbor saying, know the Lord, because they will all know him. That's the promise that he makes. Okay, so this is a very, very triumphant, joyful, promise-filled section of Jeremiah. This, all of this is going to be undone. God is going to be faithful to his promise and is going to restore everybody. Matthew has quoted the one little bummer verse, section of verses in the whole thing, which is Rachel weeping over her children. That's the little part that he's quoted. And he has taken it, seemingly, and applied it to the specific events where what are probably no more than, I mean, Bethlehem was a very small little town. We're probably talking about maybe a couple of dozen kids or something like that. I mean, not that to minimize that would be significant, but when we read about Herod slaying the infants, it's not like he went into a country and slew thousands upon thousands of children. He takes the village of Bethlehem and he destroys the male children under 2 years old. And in a small village like that, it's not going to be that many kids that we're talking about. So the question is, first of all, can we look at that passage in Jeremiah and say, that is talking about this slaying of a couple of dozen children in Bethlehem years in the future? Well, doesn't seem to. It's talking about the voice being heard in Ramah, the staging area for the captivity. It's in the context that is talking about the captivity of that has happened in the north in particular, and also in the south. And she is told to stop weeping because those who are being taken away are going to be brought back. So in Jeremiah, the passage seems pretty clearly to be about what has happened to the northern kingdom, Rachel weeping over her children, over the tribes of Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin, and what has happened in the north. And she, that picture of that voice from her tomb weeping is there precisely because God, through Jeremiah, wants to come along and reverse it and say, but she can stop crying because it's not going to always be this way. Okay. What then, having gone through all of that, what then is Matthew doing? What is going on when he quotes this? Well, there are a couple of interesting things that we note as we put this together. Here's how I would think about it. First of all, it is interesting that Matthew has taken two elements from this prophecy, one explicit and one implicit, that have a kind of a correlation with what's going on in Bethlehem. First of all, Rachel weeping for her children. In the passage, it is not babies that she's weeping over. When she's weeping over her children, it is her descendants. I mean, these are children and adults who are all being taken into captivity. She's weeping for all of them. But Matthew is picking up on this word children, because it is children in particular that are being killed in Bethlehem. And the other thing that he's picking up on is, as we've been describing, and as every Jew of the time would have known, the tomb of Rachel is just outside Bethlehem. So this picture of Rachel weeping for her children has a certain plausibility because where is Rachel's tomb? It's right there outside of Bethlehem. Children are being killed in Bethlehem, and he talks about a passage where Rachel is weeping over her children. Rachel, whose tomb is just outside the city where these children are being killed. Okay, so the choice that we face now, I hope I've managed to show you what the situation is. The choice that we face is, how is it that we are to understand what Matthew's doing? Here are some options. Option number one, Matthew is deliberately, whether we say deliberately or not, Matthew is not paying attention to the context in Jeremiah. He has no interest in what Jeremiah was saying in the prophecy. He just notices, hey, Rachel's tomb's outside of Bethlehem, and it talks about children. That's enough for me. I'm going to grab this prophecy and say, this is a prediction that these children in Bethlehem were going to die someday. Is that possible? Yes. The problem with that, of course, is what sort of credence can I give to Matthew as an apostle telling us the story of Jesus if he's going to do that kind of stuff? If he's going to say, see, I can show you, the New Testament predicted that this was going to happen. I mean, the Old Testament predicted that this was going to happen. See? Cut, paste, don't look at the book, but you've pulled, see these verses? Doesn't that look like it's talking about this? That inspires no one with much confidence in what it is that Matthew's doing. And frankly, at a time when we're trying to make a case for the messiahship of Jesus in telling this story, opponents of the gospel could easily look at that and say, well, but shouldn't we go back and see what's going on? Now, granted, some of the rabbis of the time were doing even weirder stuff with the Old Testament, but it doesn't seem like this is going to be a particularly convincing argument. Here's another option. We should understand God to have written the Old Testament in such a way that it's filled with double meanings, so that although when Jeremiah wrote it, it was intended to be about the captivity of the northern kingdom and a picture of Rachel weeping over the plight of the northern kingdom, still there was a hidden message in there about something that was going to happen to a couple of dozen children in Bethlehem, and God put that in there, but we never would have known it unless Matthew had come along and told us. That's the hidden message in the passage. This is a route that many people take. I mean, it's sort of a council of despair. What else can we do? They say, we want to take seriously the authority of the Bible. And so, if Matthew says that's what the passage means, then that must be what the passage means. And since it obviously means something else as well, it must have two meanings. It has the literal meaning that it had in the context, and then it has a deeper meaning that only an inspired apostle could find. And there have been two roads that people have taken from this. Some people would say, see, there's all kinds of double meanings to all the passages in the Bible, and therefore we should go looking for those double meanings, and we should stop paying attention to the context of passages and pull verses out and look for the other meanings that they might have as well. In other words, their conclusion from what Matthew has done here is that you should entirely ignore everything I have been saying in this class. And of course, maybe they're right, but I don't think so. The other route that people have taken is, well, the double meanings are in there, but you have to be an inspired apostle to know that they're in there. I mean, we can't go and find double meanings because we don't know whether they're in there or not. But Matthew knew that there was a special double meaning in this passage. Is that possible? Yeah. But here's where you're going to have to make your own judgment about this. But all I can say is I find that solution very unsatisfying. Because what sort of a meaning is it if I write something in a letter to someone, you know, I say, you know, someday I'm going to pick up my chair from you that you have, and then I come along years later and say, I wrote you and told you that I was going to come and get my books. And you say, well, but you told me you were going to come get your chair, but you didn't say you were going to come and get your books. And I say, well, yes, but there was a hidden meaning in what I said. That when I said chair, I was also thinking of all of those books that you have to stand on the chair to get off of the shelf. You know, I'm making this up on the spot, and it's pretty stupid, I know. But you understand the point. It's like, what kind of communication is that? What does it accomplish in the end? If I come along and say, hidden in there in a way that nobody could have known it unless I tell you is another meaning, it's like, oh, hey, gee, that was clever. But what does it do for me? It doesn't really do a whole lot for me. As a reader, for Matthew to come along and say that, you sort of get this feeling, okay, so then I suppose he could go to the story about the parting of the Red Sea and say that there's a hidden meaning in there about, who knows? I mean, let's just start multiplying them. I mean, who knows what double meanings we could find if we went looking for them? How am I supposed to know if the text itself doesn't communicate it? Then how am I supposed to know? What I've just described to you about the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom and all of that kind of stuff, I can know that because the Bible tells me that that's what's going on. And when I read in context and put it all together, it's not that hard to see what's happening. But that hidden meaning in there is coming from nowhere. I mean, never in a million years would I have thought that by reading that someday in Bethlehem some children were going to die. Why not? You know, there was several years before that, there was a bad case of measles that went through Bethlehem and a bunch of children died then too. Was that a prediction of that as well? I mean, how do I know what's going on there? So, like I say, I find that unsatisfying, and I don't think that's what God was doing. And I don't think that's what the apostles are doing when they go back to the Old Testament. I would appeal to this idea that what Matthew is doing when he says that what happened in that passage was fulfilled here is that he has a deeper meaning of the term fulfilled. He does not mean that it was a prediction of what happened here, but that there's some deeper connection between that passage and what happened here. I mean, we can see that there may be certain reasons why we might think that Matthew was doing that. For instance, the passage talks about a voice was heard in Ramah. Well, Ramah isn't where the events happen here. This happens in Bethlehem. But the proximity of Rachel's tomb to Bethlehem is enough for him to make the association, I think, that we're talking about here. So what is that association? Well, here's what I think. If we look at this Old Testament passage, it is a very rich theological passage talking about the intention of God to redeem His people, to redeem the promise that He has made to His people to restore them. Now, when Rachel is weeping over her children, she's weeping over the captivity that is happening in the north, and ultimately the events that are happening in the south with the Babylonians taking them away, they're just as bad. And has God fulfilled the promise that He made in Jeremiah yet at the time that Herod is doing what he does in Bethlehem? No. What has happened to Israel? They have gone off into captivity in Babylon. Finally, after a number of years, some of them come back. They make a kingdom for a while. They don't have a Davidic king anymore. They don't have a descendant of David sitting on the throne. Things go all right for them for a while, and finally they're conquered by the Romans, and right now they are under captivity, under the rule of the Romans. They're not dragged off to Rome. They're living in the Palestine area, but they're a conquered people. Herod is not really one of them. He's an Idumean who's been put on the throne by the Romans. And so here is this Idumean under the authority of Rome deciding, I want to kill me some Jewish children, and he does it. So the captivity that began, the judgment of God that began at the time of the captivity that Rachel is weeping over, is basically still going on. So part of the significance of the passage to what Matthew wants to do, I think, is to say Rachel weeping for her children is something that could go on for a long time, because we are still a conquered people. We are still not living in the land restored, the northern and the southern kingdom brought together under the Messiah, and so on. We are still waiting for God to fulfill those promises. So the event of the execution of the children in Bethlehem is one small example of what Rachel has been weeping over all that time, if you understand what I'm saying. It's not that the passage was predicting that particular event, but that what Rachel is weeping over is the conquest of her people. And that conquest is still going on. Now, is there more of a connection here? I think there is. Because again, I think Matthew is pointing us back and saying, look at this passage from Jeremiah. We find it fulfilled here in what's going on in this event. What is it that just happened? It's not just the death of some children. The deaths that happened with the measles several years before don't have nearly the same significance as these deaths. Because what were these deaths about? These deaths were an attempt by Herod, put on the throne by the Romans, to wipe out the Messiah of God, to wipe out the hope of Israel. He killed those children because he was trying to kill the Messiah. He was afraid that somebody was going to come along and be a contestant for his throne, and he didn't want that to happen, and so he tried to wipe out the competition. But what do we see in the story? We see in the story that although the children died, the Messiah did not die. He was rescued and taken to safety, and in the end he comes back. So, in Jeremiah, the whole passage that we see is a passage that describes the joy and the hope of the people of Israel, that God is going to restore them. And in the end, it culminates with the statement about the new covenant that God is going to make, where he's going to forgive their sins and is going to write his law on their heart. Well, we know Jesus himself said that what he came to do was to make a new covenant in his blood. That Jesus is the fulfillment, in fact, of the promises that God made through Jeremiah and others. So this passage, although Matthew is pointing to the part about Rachel weeping, at this point, what I would understand and argue for is that he is pointing us back to the whole passage and saying, what we had in Jeremiah was a picture of Rachel weeping over the captivity of her children, together with a comfort from God that one day it is going to be undone and everything is going to be restored. And all the people who have gone out under judgment, the people of Israel who went out under judgment, the nation is going to be brought back and forgiven and restored. So, what is it that's fulfilled in this story? What we see is right there in Bethlehem, right next to Rachel's tomb, we see one more example of what it is that Rachel has to weep over, and yet in the story we see the beginnings of the fulfillment of the promise that was made to Rachel, that her tears would be dried, that one day it was going to be restored and brought back. That's what we see in the story of Jesus. Herod tries to kill him, kills some Jewish children in the process, but does not kill the hope of Israel. He is not able to do it. And so Rachel is weeping for, here are a few more of her children who ultimately have suffered under this long period of exile and conquest and so on. And yet we see in the story, even as death is happening, God is overcoming it and is going to bring about the restoration that he promised through the Messiah who escaped here. So just as the conquest, the captivity of the northern and southern kingdom, God is saying in Jeremiah, is not the extinction of the hopes of Israel. It may look like it, but they are going to be rescued. So Herod's attempt to snuff out the hope of Israel in the person of Jesus was unsuccessful. Rachel has some more children to weep over, but in the end, the restoration will happen because God's Messiah escaped, and he is going to bring about the restoration. Now, I recognize that in what I've just done, let me tell you what I've done. I have gone back, I have looked at the passage in the context and asked, what is the theological statement of Jeremiah? What is the theology? What is the message that it proclaims? And I would argue that that message is profoundly messianic, if you understand the word as I'm using it. It is intended to describe the hope of Israel that is going to be brought about through the Messiah. It talks about the tears of Rachel, but it talks about her ultimate joy because what has been brought upon them as a judgment is going to be ultimately undone. Well, my argument is that Matthew is not just saying, oh, forget about the context, this is a prediction about what happens to these couple of dozen children, but he is rather richly building on the theology of Jeremiah. And what he's saying is that just as Rachel was weeping back then, but ultimately her tears will be dried, so we see in this story, in Bethlehem, right next to the tomb of Rachel, one more example of her tears, what it is that she has to cry over, and yet ultimately those tears will be dried. What I have done is I have made a theological connection between the two things, and I'm arguing that that's what Matthew intends us to do. That he's not saying that was a prediction of this event, but saying that statement about that event has real significance, and ultimately it finds a deeper significance in these events that happened in that area. Because here we have the captivity of the people, and that's significant, but here we have an attempt to wipe out the Messiah himself, and yet it came to nothing in the end. I would argue that if we go and look at Out of Egypt I Called My Son, or the Virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and he shall be named Emmanuel. If we go and look at each of those passages, what we find is a deep theological connection between them. And so, now, I acknowledge in what I've said that you could argue, well, Ron, you read an awful lot into that stuff. Yeah, I did. I read a lot into it. But I didn't read anything into the Old Testament passage that's not there. I mean, we can make a very, very cogent and clear argument for that passage being profoundly messianic. What I have read into it is my assumption that Matthew is not an idiot, and that Matthew understands the passage at least as well as we can by looking at it. Can't you imagine that Matthew probably understands that passage at least as well as I do, considering the fact that a lot of these things I'm talking about here, I had to go look up in books and say, okay, now which one was Jacob again, and all that kind of stuff. He didn't have to do that. I mean, the Jews were educated in all of this stuff. This was their heritage. Of course he knew this story. Of course he knew what Jeremiah was doing. So my assumption is that Matthew did understand that, and the connection that he's making is not a trivial one of just, oh, look, Bethlehem, children, but rather a deep theological one, that he sees the significance of the passage for what it is that has happened in the life of Jesus. And that's what we see in some of the other passages as well. Out of Egypt I called my son. It's not talking about Jesus specifically coming out of Egypt, but it is a profoundly messianic passage that talks about the restoration of the hopes of Israel, and so on. Okay, well, as I suspected, I don't have time to look at the other passages that I was going to talk about tonight. We won't go there, I think. This will be enough for that. But what I wanted to get across to you is I want to give you just a taste of how it might be. And I think it is something like this, that the connection between the Old Testament and the New Testament is built primarily around the very deep theme in the Old Testament that God is going to send His Messiah, His anointed one, His chosen king, His deliverer, to fulfill the promises to Israel. And that in one way or another, the New Testament authors over and over again are making these linkages to passages that explore that hope and that messianic idea in order to bring out the connection between them. Now, Matthew, I think, this is the hardest part of it, but Matthew in particular has this thing that he does in these passages where the passages that he chooses have these links. Egypt is the link in the one of them. Children is the link in this passage. The maiden bearing a son is the link in the Isaiah passage. There are these links that he's pointing to, but it's not just the superficial similarity of language that he's pointing to, but the deep theological connection between them. That's how I would understand it at this point. Okay, I've said that not because I expect that each of us here as readers of the Bible, we're going to sit down and we're going to find a New Testament passage using an Old Testament passage, and we're immediately going to say, oh, hey, I know, I got it, and I'm going to run to it. I know this takes thinking about. It takes, in order to see what's happening here, it takes some of what I was describing at the beginning. You've kind of got to get familiar with some of the history and the background so you can have a picture of what it is that's happening. But what I would like to leave you with is my conviction that I would like you to consider, at any rate, my conviction that the New Testament authors understand the Old Testament very well, and that the connections they're making between them are not trivial ones, but they are deep and profound ones. And they actually bear a lot of fruit. When you start to look and see the connections they're making, there's really a lot there to be seen. So it's that conviction, really, that I want to leave you with as you go out and are students of the Bible and you encounter this sort of thing. The next time somebody says to you, oh, I don't know, the New Testament is so strange the way it uses the Old Testament, I'd just like to ask you to consider the possibility that maybe it's not really so strange at all. Okay. Any questions or comments about anything? Yeah.
I just want to repeat. You're saying that the quotation here, the main reason he makes that quotation is just to point to the messianic message that Israel will be restored. Is that his main point in that quote?
Well,
would that be the first most important point? I guess that.
Yeah, except in saying that's the most important point, we're getting at it through. It starts with the negative point, with the weeping. Rachel was weeping then, and here's another example of something for Rachel to weep over. So we find the continuation of that theme. But the passage from Jeremiah, the whole reason that it talks about Rachel's weeping is so that it can go on to say that she's going to be comforted. And I think that that part of it is why it's a fitting comparison as well. Yeah, I don't want to ignore the weeping part. I mean, it's relevant, and that's the tie. That's the place where he's tying them together.
Would you say that Matthew is tying that together, saying, just like he was trying to say in the Old Testament passage about bringing everyone together and making this whole unity again, that's what's happening now. That's what's about to happen.
Yeah, this is the time when God is setting out to do the thing that he had promised them. It's still a time of weeping. I mean, here are more Jewish children dead. Rachel still has something to weep about, but this was in an attempt to do in the Messiah, and it did not succeed. As we know, it can't, because God promised that Rachel's tears are going to be dried one day.
Can you maybe just give us the verse numbers you were going to go on to, and we may become exegetes this week?
Well, the passage, now I'm almost, because you're...
Not really.
No, I just, you're going to laugh because, of course, there was no chance in the world that I had time to go on and talk about this. So, what in the world was I thinking? What I was going to talk about, if I had time, was the beginning of the book of Hebrews, where the author of Hebrews quotes 2 Samuel 7 and Psalm 2. You are my son, today I have begotten you, and I will be a son, I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. And again, the connection I was going to make there was, again, to explore those are equally messianic passages if we understand ultimately what's going on. And that's what I was going to talk about another time. That's, if you're interested, we'll talk about that sometime. That's very interesting, crucial, kind of fundamental stuff in terms of our theology of the Messiah and what all of that stuff means. Yeah.
Just to further this story a little bit, is Rachel still weeping?
Yeah, I think so. Because the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans, it seems to me, was the final and greatest stroke against the Jewish people. It's like the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and finally the Romans. And we're still living in... I mean, once again, there are Jews back in the land of Palestine, but still, what has been described here has not been brought about. So we're still waiting for the fulfillment of that. And that's very much what was surprising to the Jews of the time, even Jesus' disciples. If you read what's referred to as the Olivet Discourse, the teaching that Jesus gives on the Mount of Olives soon before the crucifixion, his disciples are asking him, "So, when are you going to establish the kingdom?" You know, it's a, You were just talking about the temple being destroyed. Boy, that sounds pretty cataclysmic. When's that going to happen? And I assume that must be like all part of the last stuff here, right? So tell us, when's that going to happen? And when are you going to come in glory and all of that? And his message to them is basically, it's going to be a long time. In fact, I don't even know when it is. I mean, basically he says to them, I don't know. The Father knows, I don't know. But you should be like maidens who go out to meet the bridegroom and they realize that they had better take an extra flask of oil for their lamps because he might be a long time in coming back. And if you're not prepared for him being a long time in coming back, then you may get caught unawares. You know, you're going to be waiting and waiting and find out, I don't have any oil for my lamp, I'm going to have to go get some. So we're so used to the idea of the first coming and the second coming and all of that kind of stuff, but you can see how in the Old Testament people would have gotten the idea from what was written there. He's going to bring us back into the land, he's going to restore everything, so, I mean, that should happen any day now, right? That's what the Jews were looking for. I mean, we're back in the land, so, but we're still captives here. We're waiting for the Messiah to come and to free us and to unite us and to make all of this stuff happen. And the Messiah came and he went away again. And that, in terms of what it is that God had said he was going to do, when you stop and look at it after the fact, you can kind of look and say, oh, okay, well, I can kind of see that there are intimations of this in the Old Testament, but it's not immediately apparent that that's the way it's going to happen. So, yes, I would say everything that has happened from the time of the captivity in Babylon and all of that through the various conquerors they had, through the Roman conquest, through Rome finally destroying them, through them wandering in the nations for thousands of years, and they're coming back into Palestine again now. All of that is a part of this period of time, this time of Jacob's trouble, that one day is going to come to an end. Yeah. So yeah, she's still weeping.
Is Jesus' use of the scripture quotes from Isaiah when he's in the synagogue, is one of his first teachings in the synagogue, that quotes about Isaiah 61. Would you consider, I mean, when I went back to the Isaiah passage, Isaiah seems to be talking about himself. I'm preaching a, he's not talking about.
Yes, that's a very good question.
It looks almost like the same thing's happening there as what you just said.
Yeah. Actually, at this point, I know what you're saying, because it's in the first person.
In Isaiah.
God has anointed me to preach good news to the poor and that kind of stuff. Yeah. It's possible, and people debate over how we should understand what's happening in Isaiah. At this point, though, I'm inclined to think that those passages in Isaiah actually are intended to be messianic. That there's this theme that runs through Isaiah of the suffering servant and so on. And there are certainly passages, if you remember, this is not exactly the passage that you're talking about, but in Acts, when Philip talks to the Ethiopian eunuch, Philip runs alongside this chariot that has the Ethiopian eunuch, and he knows the Ethiopian eunuch is reading because he can hear him, because people read out loud when they read back in these days, so he could hear what was going on. He said, do you understand what you're reading? Well, he says, how could I unless somebody guides me? He invites Philip up. Now, the passage of scripture which he was reading was this, and it's from Isaiah. It's not from that passage, but it's another one in Isaiah. He was led as a sheep to slaughter, and as a lamb before its shearer is silent, so he does not open his mouth. In humiliation his judgment was taken away. Who shall relate his generation, for his life is removed from the earth? And the eunuch answered Philip and said, "Please tell me, of whom does the prophet say this, of himself or of someone else?" And he's asking that very question. So who's he talking about here? And then Philip opened his mouth, and beginning from the scripture, he preached Jesus to him. Well, I mean, you could argue various ways, but I think Philip is saying that is a predictive passage, and it's talking about the sufferings of the Messiah. And so I think there are a number of passages in Isaiah that are actually intended to be predictions. But that's a very good question. The question you're asking, that's exactly what we should be asking ourselves. Don't just assume, because they quote it, that it is intended to be a prediction. But you don't want to misunderstand me as saying that there are no predictions in the Old Testament either, because there are. There are definitely passages that are intended to talk about this guy, this one guy coming in the future. And I think a number of them in Isaiah are intended to be that way. But that's a very smart way to approach that. You don't want to make that assumption.
Along those lines, do you think that the prophets understood when they were putting this into words that it was a prediction? What was their understanding of what they were doing?
That's a very hard question to answer. I think they had varying levels of understanding, depending on kind of what the message was that they were proclaiming. On the extreme, I think we can take someone like Daniel, who had visions. And in these visions, he sees, you know, a goat with one horn longer than the other, and so on. And it's pretty clear, as Daniel relates it, that he doesn't know what it means. He's seeing this picture. And in fact, usually what happens is there's an angel or something standing around in the vision, and he goes to him and says, "What was that? What was that all about?" And sometimes the angel says, "Well, okay, let me tell you. That goat with the horns, that was Greece," and he actually gives him some sort of an explanation. So in that situation, you can really picture God is giving this vision that has a symbolic meaning, that is intended, it's like an allegory. And God is the one who's sticking the meaning in there directly. I mean, he didn't make this story up, and he doesn't even know what it means. He's just recording what he saw. I think the book of Revelation presents itself as like that, and I think that's true as well, that John basically describes this as Jesus coming to him and saying, "I have something to show you." And he shows him. And John records what it is that he has seen. I don't think John made it up. And I don't think John knew what it meant. Now, when we get to a lot of what the prophets have to say, that Daniel and the book of Revelation are kind of one kind of prophetic literature. But some of the other prophetic literature is more, you know, it's more straightforward sort of descriptions of the evil of the rulers in Israel and the judgment that God's going to bring upon them and so on. And there, I think the prophets understand quite clearly what it is they're saying. But they keep saying, "Thus saith the Lord," that this is what God is saying to people. So it's a little bit hard to know whether, I mean, in the end, we don't exactly know what the experience of being a prophet is like, how much they understood of this message that God was giving them. We have the cryptic statement of Peter in 2 Peter. I think it's 2 Peter where he says this. Yes. Where was that? Oh, it's gone out of my head. Where that? I've forgotten. Somewhere in Peter, he talks about how the prophets wanted to understand, what are we talking about? I mean, you kind of get the picture of they're proclaiming this message from God, and they're basically asking God, and what is this about? And it was revealed to them that they were serving not themselves but you, or something like that. It's gone out of my head a little bit. But basically, that they were told enough about what was going on that they knew they were talking about something that was not going to happen to them, but it was something that was in the future. So the picture seems to be of a message that has come from God that they are proclaiming, that they have something of an understanding of, but were clearly not the authors of themselves. And to a certain extent, they had questions about this. You know, if God came to me and gave me a message to proclaim, and it was somewhat cryptic as to what the message was, I would wonder, you know, have I just proclaimed my own death? Have I just proclaimed my own salvation? I mean, is what I just talked about and predicted, is that going to happen next week? I mean, is the new heavens and the new earth just around the corner? I would wonder those things. And I think what Peter's saying is they wondered that too. And they were told enough that they knew, basically, no, it's not for you. Just, you're going to live and you're going to die, and none of these things that I've described are going to happen yet. So probably they didn't at least fully understand what they were saying. Much of it, though, would have been quite understandable. I mean, as I say, the judgment they were pronouncing and the wickedness of the rulers and what they did in perverting justice and all of that. They knew what they were saying very much there.
Could you clarify again how Rachel's still weeping, and yet the declaration that Jeremiah has made has been fulfilled in Jesus?
Right. Well, because think about it this way. I'm going to read something to you here. This is what John the Baptist's father says when his mouth is opened, finally, when John is born. "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited us and accomplished redemption for his people, and has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of David his servant, as he spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets from of old, salvation from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to show mercy toward our fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath which he swore to Abraham our father, to grant us that we, being delivered from the hand of our enemies, might serve him without fear, in holiness and righteousness before him all our days." Well, he's talking about John the Baptist as the one who proclaims, who is the forerunner to the Messiah. Zacharias understands this is the time when the Messiah is born. And he also understands the promise that the Messiah is going to rescue the people of God from their enemies. I mean, ultimately, life is going to be restored. And yet, what we find in what Jesus did is he proclaimed his message, he died on the cross to bring about the deliverance from sin that was very much a part of that message. The Jeremiah passage, for instance, talks about God forgiving the sins of the people. So Jesus' death is the establishment of, like, the foundation of the promises that God has made. His death has made it possible for God to bring about the forgiveness that he promised. But the job isn't done yet. The New Testament several times refers to Psalm 110 that uses that language in talking to the Messiah, saying, God saying to him, "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet." And the New Testament authors basically describe the time we're living in now as the time when Jesus is sitting at the right hand of the Father, meaning the place of authority. He has been crowned. His resurrection has won the victory and he is the king, but his enemies have not been made a footstool for his feet. So yes, Rachel would have lifted up her head, I mean, in a way, and said, yes, here is the beginning of God keeping his promises. But those promises haven't been fulfilled in their completeness until the kingdom of God is established and the world truly is made right and justice prevails and all of that kind of stuff. So in essence, I mean, that's a profound question that you're asking, because that's right where we're living. We're living in the place where Jesus has done everything that is necessary to fulfill the promises of God, but what remains is for what he has done to be actualized and worked out in the world. So that's why I answer the way I do. It's different. We're living in a different time than the time before him, because the Messiah has come and the price of his life has been paid and he is the king. But we're still waiting for the culmination of that. So in that sense, especially for the Jewish people, who are the ones that she was weeping for in particular, it's still the time of weeping, because the coming of Jesus has not yet culminated in the restoration of them as a people, which I think the Bible promises and which is something that's still in the future. I think the Bible still holds out a picture that God is going to complete his promises to the children of Abraham. And those promises still remain to be fulfilled. They're on their way.
So then is the part where Jeremiah talks about, you know, put my law in their minds and no longer will a man teach his neighbor, is that now or is that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. See, these are good questions that you're asking, and they're hard questions. If I had to answer it right now, I would say fundamentally no, it is not now. That what Jesus did on the cross made possible the new covenant that God said he's going to make with Israel. You and I are already, we're a part of that. That is, the forgiveness that Jesus brought about, we as Gentile believers now are a part of that forgiveness. And the hope in the future, in his kingdom, we have a share in that hope. But the one thing that Jeremiah is promising there that has not happened yet is it's not just a new covenant that he's making that various people on the earth are going to be forgiven. It's that the northern and the southern kingdoms are going to be brought back together and healed, and everyone in the land is going to know God. So it's that part of it that hasn't happened yet. There, I would say Jesus has laid the foundation. He has made a new covenant, but what has not yet happened is the nation of Israel as a people coming together under that covenant. And that's the thing that still remains, I think.